As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, welcome to the Austin and Chapman podcast on The Athletic. As usual, we'll bring you exclusive insight and stories from our team of writers, joined by David Ornstein, Adam Crafton, and The Athletic's Manchester United correspondent, Laurie Whitwell. We're going to look today at David's exclusive story on Mesut Ozil leaving Arsenal. We'll look at the fallout from Liverpool-Manchester United, and also Chelsea apparently stepping up their pursuit of Erling Haaland. Let's start, though, with Mesut Ozil. David, breaking the news on Saturday morning that he'd reached an agreement to leave Arsenal and end his seven-year spell at the club and move to Fenerbahce. What are the numbers involved? How did they eventually get to the stage where he's off their books?
What we do know is that Mesut Ozil will be leaving some money on the table. We don't know how much money that is. But he will be forgoing a proportion of the money that he is owed by Arsenal, because obviously he was due to be under contract until the end of June 2021. He's over in Turkey now finalising the transfer. So Arsenal just need to work through the paperwork with their lawyers, Ozil's lawyers, the Fenerbahce lawyers. Ozil then needs to pretty much just undergo a medical, put pen to paper on a deal that has been agreed for a little bit of time. And that will bring the curtain down on one chapter and raise it on another. And plenty to get stuck into for us too.
Within the club, how do they feel about how it's ended? When you tweeted this out, what was the Arsenal fans' reaction?
Symptomatic of the last few years, which has been a split fan base over Mesut Ozil, the reaction to his departure has been divided too. There's been quite a lot of nostalgia now that it's over. Memories of all the good times that Arsenal had under him or with him. But there has been a lot of resentment as well that since his new contract in 2018, it, for one reason or another, many reasons actually, it's gone pretty much downhill throughout. A lot of fans sad to see him go, a lot pleased to see the back of him. A lot of fans angry with Arsenal, a lot of fans pleased with Arsenal. Within the club, that mixture of emotions is replicated. They wish that it would have worked out better from the club's point of view, from Ozil's point of view, but they recognise that by this point, it just had to come to an end. He went to say his goodbyes at London Colney on Sunday, and I don't think there was any great song and dance, any huge presentation. It's obviously difficult with the COVID restrictions about what buildings you're allowed to be in and how close you can get to each other. At least by the end, it was an amicable, dignified and cordial exit. It sounds like Edu, Arsenal's technical director, was very impressive in the negotiations over the termination. Very straightforward from Fenerbahce's point of view to deal with, and from Ozil's camp's perspective, a bit of a strange situation because obviously it's been a fairly bitter lead up until this point and now it's all over. I guess there was respect and professionalism on all sides at the end.
Yeah, David, given the, I suppose, how difficult it's been between Ozil and Arsenal over the last few months, and it's been quite farcical on, you know, social media at times where you've had Ozil almost commentating along during matches. Why did they wait so long to come to this agreement? Why couldn't they do it back in October, November, were there still hopes that Arteta might bring him back into the fold or that he might show something? Why have they waited this long to do it?
Well, they could, of course, done it even earlier. They could have done it at some point in 2020 when the writing appeared to be on the wall because Mikel Arteta, despite starting him in each of his first 10 matches as Arsenal manager before the lockdown, didn't play him a minute after that. It would have been obviously far more expensive to ask for Arsenal to do so at that stage. And I don't think that was something they were contemplating. I'm not sure they knew it was the complete end for him. There were some discussions between Arsenal and Ozil's representatives about finding a solution, but it was never mentioned that they would pay off his contract at that point. It was always about trying to help him find a transfer to another club. He also, as we reported on The Athletic, I think in early October, that in September, he received a loyalty bonus of around £8 million. And there are some who say he wouldn't have been prepared to leave before that, unless, of course, Arsenal paid him off all of his salary and the loyalty bonus. Once that was done and the beginning of October came, they had a decision on their hands. From Arsenal's perspective, are we going to reintegrate him and register him for the squad for the upcoming season in the Premier League and Europa League, or are we going to leave him out? Very late in the window, it was relayed, we understand, to Ozil that there was a chance he wouldn't be registered because they had no intention of playing him. They had other options, etc. And it was at that point that they kind of knew for the first time that he might not be registered, but there was only 3 or 4 days to go until the transfer window shut. And for a transfer, for a move of this magnitude, that just isn't enough time. Previously to that, you're right, he was always determined to fight his way back into contention and win a place back in the side. He said that to us in 2 interviews we've done with him. And from having been the person who was speaking to him on both occasions, I really sensed that was authentic, that he believed he would go to the last day of his Arsenal contract because he could play. But when he wasn't registered for the Europa League and Premier League squads, he knew at that point that it was pretty much game over. And so with more time heading into the January window and no indication from either side or no feeling from either side that squad situation was going to change and he'd be re-registered, I think that's when he instructed his people to sort out a move. Talks could start legally at the start of January, and they struck this deal with Fenerbahce that seems to suit all parties.
You will know there are all sorts of rumours around why he didn't play. Do you think they are just rumours? Do you think there are stories that will come out in the future about why he hasn't been in the squad?
I'd like to think I would have known about those already. I've heard the same things as you, that it was... Well, he intimated in the interview that we did with him, I think it was in August, that he feels it was related to not accepting the pay cut and his stance on that, which of course didn't go down well at Arsenal because they wanted everybody to take it. They wanted it to be unanimous. As far as we know, or it was reported, he was the only one. He said in our interview that he thinks there were others who didn't take the cut. And why did only his name come out? So that's a factor that we should take into consideration, I guess. There was his very forthright comments and statement in December of 2019 on the treatment of Uyghur Muslims in China. But he did play after that point. He, as we said, he played all of Arteta's games in the Premier League before the COVID-related shutdown of football. I don't know, since then, there have been incidents like Gunnosaurus that we reported that wouldn't have gone down well with the club. It was sort of quite embarrassing from their perspective, offering to pay for him after the man in the suit was made redundant. Arsenal's view has always been that it's footballing reasons solely, and that their analysis suggests that he's not at the level to do what they want from that type of player anymore. And they watch him in training and maybe his attitude and his standards are not where Mikel Arteta wants them to be. He has always maintained that he has never changed his standards in training throughout his entire career, nor his body language, and that it is purely the perception of him from coaches. Arsene Wenger clearly worked with that in a way. Unai Emery and Mikel Arteta clearly expected more. Do I think more will come out in the coming times. Yeah, there may be nuggets of information about what's happened over the last few years. And you know, we're preparing a piece that will go out when this move is official, which will explain some of that. But I don't sense, and I stand to be corrected, that there's some sort of smoking gun here, that some extraordinary revelation that will unravel this entire mystery. I just think for some on and off field reasons, it's been gradual decline in relations, in opportunities, and ultimately it's led us to a point that is no great surprise to anybody, although regrettable to many.
United have obviously got, sorry to change the club, but United have got a few players in these situations, and clearly there's discussions going on with a number of players over there, agreements over cancelling contracts and the payoffs. And I'm intrigued to know perhaps a little bit about the negotiations. I know it's very difficult to put a price, a figure on what he might have given up, Mesut Ozil, but it's that sort of balance, isn't it, between a player wanting to get free and be able to play it again, but also not giving up too much of his salary that he's committed to.
I don't imagine it would be a huge amount of money, given that Ozil is entitled to his salary until the end of his contract. It was Arsenal's decision ultimately to move him on. And that's why he always said he was staying to the end, because he says that he wanted to still be at Arsenal. And as such, you would, of course, expect to be paid all of your money, you know, not my decision to go, sort of thing. In the circumstances of him leaving, what we don't know is how much Fenerbahce are able to pay at this point in time. There are some complications with their finances. It may be possible, going on precedent, that they might not be able to pay, for example, until the summer, when they would have ideally probably liked to have taken him. And if that's the case, then of course Arsenal would be expected by Ozil to keep paying him in some way or another. I don't think it's going to be a case of him receiving two full salaries. Definitely not. And so I would imagine that, you know, there's an agreement of sorts, but I don't think it would be anything drastic. And if that's the case, and Ozil receives most of his money from Arsenal, then you're in a position where you say Arsenal have basically moved him on to move him out of the club, mm-hmm. not to save money, not to free up a squad space, because he didn't have one anyway, just to get him away. And that's really sad when you think back to his great days as an Arsenal player.
Sorry to put you on the spot on this, but if you have, you know, you look at the way that Ozil's been interpreted by pundits, by journalists, by his two managers, Emery and Arteta, what's the reaction been, I suppose, this season from the players, those who he's been alongside in the dressing room for the last few years? I mean, I just saw on your column on The Athletic this morning talking about how Aubameyang and Lacazette are already having a joke over who takes the number 10 shirt. But has the current of feeling in the dressing room been with him, or have players just sort of sidestepped it a little bit?
You may have to judge it over the course of time. Mesut Ozil was a very popular character in the dressing room as far as we know, in the majority of his Arsenal career. We heard quite a few stories about Alexis Sanchez being quite a difficult character, not especially popular with some teammates, having some run-ins with teammates and staff. Maybe that was a bit his character, but also his relentless desire to play and win. And even if he was injured, he would go out on the training pitches. It didn't always go down well. Mesut Ozil has been very popular with his closest friends, clearly a bit of a sort of German-speaking clique in Skodra Mustafi, Serd Kolasinac. Obviously, he clearly got quite friendly, as you'd see on social media, with Matteo Guendouzi. Some young players looked up to him greatly. Imagine, you know, being a young player at Arsenal when you sign this superstar from Real Madrid and a World Cup winner a year later. And then there were some other players too. I think Danny Welbeck, for example, was very close to him, and they shared, I remember reading that they shared a holiday together at one point. Staff have spoken well of him as a person and a human. Some staff question his training standards and work rates. Others have said that they had no problem with him at all. But then you come to more recent times, and the acrimony with Unai Emery, you know, suggests that he was probably possibly ostracized a little bit within the squad, because he wasn't a key part of it, clearly, by that point. And so, you know, while being a popular figure, you're not around people as much. He missed quite a few games. He was left out of squads. And as you know, when you're preparing for match days in these clubs, you often line up against the first team, the starting 11, and that wouldn't, I'm sure, have sat well with Ozil. And then, you know, things got a bit better under Freddie Ljungberg and Arteta. And I don't think those sorts of coaches would welcome someone back into the team if they were deeply unpopular. To the contrary, I think they were broadly popular. But I'm sure there were some elements of the dressing room that could see what was happening and are not stupid and were in favour with those coaches, and so probably didn't have such a good view of Mesut Ozil. I'm sure that there is that. They have influences around them as well, probably telling them what they think of Ozil. And so I'm sure it wasn't unanimous support for him, but broadly quite popular. And what was really tricky, of course, would have been the wage cut situation, because you had Mesut Ozil not taking it, telling us in his interviews that he felt especially disappointed or sorry for the young players. Many of those don't have much of a say in these matters. You know, they're trying to make their careers at Arsenal and they're being asked to take a pay cut, and they're probably quite fearful of saying no. Whereas somebody of Ozil's stature doesn't care about that sort of thing. He clearly stands up for what he feels is right. And so it makes for a really difficult dynamic behind the scenes with teammates. And I don't know, a little bit strange seeing those Instagram lighthearted comments between Aubameyang and Lacazette. I don't think they'd actually said a farewell before they were already joking about the shirt number. And while they appear from previous interactions to have been quite good friends of Mesut Ozil, it did feel a little bit odd. I know the number 10 jersey has been a talk among sections of the squad in the last few days already. But of
has
course,
it?
Those...
Has it? I mean, I know squad numbers can be quite a big thing for some players and at some clubs, but it strikes me as a very Arsenal thing to finally get rid of what is perceived as a problem around the place in Mesut Ozil, get rid of him and right, we start afresh, and then have a massive bundle between the squad as to who gets his shirt.
I don't think it was anything serious. As I said, I thought it was a bit odd coming before goodbyes, but that's a public thing, and they did say their goodbyes privately to Ozil at the training ground.
I know, and it can be lighthearted, but Laurie, you will know from the Manchester United side of things, you know, the story was Anthony Martial's form fell off a cliff because he lost the number 9 shirt to Zlatan. I mean, for some of them, it's a really important thing, particularly when a lot of them have their numbers on their social media handles as well.
Well, absolutely. Well, Anthony Martial, as you say, had it ready to go that summer as a sort of big brand launch, and then it's whipped away from him. So not only is he taking a bit of a commercial hit, but a kind of status hit, you know, and obviously then was pushed to the wing, and you know, Ibrahimovic and Lukaku both in that centre striker role. And then, I mean, yeah, customarily now, you know, clubs don't announce the number of the player. Amad Diallo was one, for example. United confirmed his arrival this month and sort of then trailed his squad number for another post because they want to get sort of hits on two stories for the website. So, it has become quite a significant talking point, sort of squad numbers for certainly among fans as well as maybe among players.
He has had the shirt number this season. It's not gone.
are we going there already, Adam?
A quick one. How do you think he'll be remembered within the Premier League? Adam, you go first.
I suppose the longer we go and the more time that goes on, the more fondly he'll probably be remembered. I think that's the way it tends to work, isn't it, with these things. I remember seeing him play for Arsenal against Leicester. I think it was Leicester at home early in Brendan Rodgers' period, and he was unbelievable for 45 minutes of that game. I think he'll be remembered as someone capable of brilliant moments, but probably not a brilliant player for Arsenal. A bit like, you know, if Paul Pogba was to leave Manchester United at the moment, you'd say there's been some fabulous moments, but did he really do everything he could to be the best he could be at that football club? Probably not.
Laurie?
Yeah, unfulfilled promise probably. I remember when, you know, he signed for Arsenal and the massive fanfare and the expectation and the fact that Arsenal had kind of gazumped probably Manchester United to get him. And I was actually sent over to Germany to do a background on him when he was playing for the German national team. And that was quite fun sort of finding out about his, growing up on, you know, cage football in Gelsenkirchen. And so So he clearly was an incredibly talented player. The ball manipulation and some of the goals, as Adam says, you know, I'm sure we'll look back on and think, wow, what a talent. But I think just that ultimately unfulfilled promise at Arsenal.
David, finally?
It will be split into two parts, the pre and post 2018 contract renewal Ozil. Before it, he did some magical things. There was a 3-0 win against Manchester United at the Emirates, 3-0 win, 3-1 against Chelsea at the Emirates a year previously. There was that incredible goal in the Europa League where he sort of ran half the length of the pitch only a couple of years ago. That was under Emery as well. But there's so many layers to this story in terms of why it went wrong and his version versus the club's version, and how Arsene Wenger put his arm around him and the other coaches didn't. That he won't be remembered as a Premier League great, but he was one of the great players who played in the Premier League and was capable of so many great moments. There was an incredible moment when he brought it back to 3-3, I think, or 3-2 against Liverpool at the Emirates with an amazing goal where he sort of kicked the ball into the ground, which became a bit of his trademark. The Premier League seems to have lost so many of its creators, its mercurial talents, and that's, we can do a podcast on that in itself. And Ozil is definitely one of them. We look at the likes of Thiago and Bruno Fernandes now, and hopefully they can take it on. But the football has become much more pragmatic, mechanical, results orientated rather than performance, which I understand to an extent. But it's a shame that there's not a place now for an Ozil in modern football. But he must take his share of responsibility as well, because when he signed his new contract, I think Arsene Wenger said he was now expected to become a leader and help this team to more success. And unfortunately, for many reasons, that didn't happen.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu.
Let's move on. We won't talk Arsenal anymore because we're going to talk the title race now. Hi, Bob.
Waiting for that one, haven't you?
Yeah, I know, yeah.
Just cyclical, David smile. Cyclical.
Liverpool and Manchester United were goalless yesterday. How have United fans reacted to that in chats with you, Laurie?
I think broadly, positively. I mean, you know, as we were discussing off air before the game, you know, we do the Q&A when the team sheet drops, and a lot of fans were critical of the team selection, Cavani out of the team and Eric Bailly out of the team, which I think you can debate certainly both of them, but the kind of venom that was directed towards Solskjaer for those selections, I'm always a bit quizzical over because the match hasn't happened yet. And as it happened, I thought Lindelof had a really good game and United had the two best chances. So when you go to a place like Liverpool, Anfield, you know, not beaten there in the Premier League since April 2017, not been denied scoring since October 2018 against Manchester City. So those sort of two aspects, I think you have to look at it and go, it's a point gained, but perhaps the way the match went, it felt a bit like a missed opportunity. Certainly that's what Solskjaer sort of reflected on afterwards, the fact that they had Fabinho and Jordan Henderson at centre-back, and could United have actually taken advantage of that to a greater degree and made a real statement win? I think it was possibly there for them to do that. You know, I think I've mentioned it a few times, but the way that Leicester went to Man City and won in the season that they won the title, you know, unexpectedly, I think that was a Liverpool yesterday was a potential for United to do that. So I suppose in the fullness of time, you'll see, you know, if they go to Fulham and win that game, then it sustains the run, the unbeaten away form as well. And I think you can see progress, certainly from the last two visits to Anfield when United were, you know, beaten fairly comfortably. I think certainly a 0-0, having had the better of the quality chances, is to be sort of praised.
Well, that was Solskjaer's point, Adam, afterwards, was, you know, it's only a good point if they win the next one.
Yeah, and it's always going to be that way. I agree with Lowy. I thought United were absolutely fine yesterday in terms of how they set up.
Emphatically fine.
Emphatically fine. Yeah, I thought, you know, all these top, what you would consider conventional top six games this season have been a bit like this. Man City and Liverpool basically settled for a draw. Man United and Man City drew 0-0. Chelsea and Spurs drew 0-0. It's almost like everyone was just so stunned by Spurs going to Old Trafford and winning 6-1 that they've all been spooked out of having a go in these matches. But I think at this point, everyone's just keen to make sure that when it gets to March, they're around it. And I think that's the way it's playing out at the moment. No one's really pulling away. Man City have had 3 or 4 good weeks. Let's see if it becomes 7 or 8 good weeks. I think from Manchester United's point of view, they can say they've gone to Anfield, had the better chances. You know, De Gea made what, one save from the Thiago strike from distance. There was nothing really, you know, to really concern them. I don't agree with this idea that's come out after the game that United should have gone through it in the first 45 minutes. I think when you go to Anfield, you have to respect the occasion that you're playing and you earn the right to play. And then as the game goes along, those moments emerge. And they had probably 3 or 4 moments where they should have scored. So I think it was as good as Manchester United could have got at this moment in time. I think the problem they do have is they've got an inconsistent forward line. And they don't have, unless Cavani, you know, has that run in the team and comes good, I think they've got a bit of a problem in terms of Greenwood, Rashford and Martial, in terms of someone producing a moment of real certainty in a big game. They're not getting goals in these big games. And those players have asked for a lot of responsibility over the last couple of years. And in some ways they've stepped up to that. But I think, you know, if United are going to go from being challengers to major contenders, that's what has to change. They have to get more goals out of either Rashford, Martial or Greenwood.
Adam, you mentioned the Tottenham results and it seemed doom and gloom at United when they were beaten by Arsenal at Old Trafford. And then when we think about Liverpool's rampant last couple of years, admittedly, they've had a dip, they've had their injuries, etc., but they're still capable of tearing teams apart. I know what the likes of Micah Richards have said about you don't win a league title with what Manchester United have got, but my goodness, and I don't want to be the sort of sympathiser here, maybe a bit of an antidote to the other two, but this is not a bad platform to be building. I know Manchester United's expectations are different, but seems a bit of a knee-jerk reaction to kind of dismiss a 0-0 at Anfield.
Totally. If you'd have offered that to United before the game, that have snatched it. To leave Anfield still top of the league, almost halfway through the season, really good. I think as well, I think some of the things that are being said about Liverpool are a bit unfair at the moment in terms of, you know, they're having a bit of a tricky period. But I think for them to be in the position they're in without their two first-choice centre-backs, not really having had Thiago fit for most of the season as well, Jota being out, I think if you'd have offered them to be within punching distance of the top two at this point, they'd be happy. I think if you go round all the sort of, probably apart from Mikel Arteta, if you go round those managers at the top of the league, I think they'll all be quite happy. And there's no one, there's been a sense of, apart from Frank Lampard, there's been a sense of crisis around, you know, United early on in the season, City a little bit, but no, none of it's really convincing. And you're almost just waiting for something to happen this season that really sparks it into life.
Yeah, and Laurie, they used to be great front runners in the second half of the season, United, but obviously this is a completely different era. And when you look at the form of City, I don't think United will be getting carried away, really starting to think they're title contenders yet, or am I wrong?
I think they have to think they're title contenders because it's such an alien year. And if they don't, then they're passing up an opportunity that's right in front of them. That being said, you're spot on. I think City do look you know, they look resilient, don't they? The back line have got sorted, and the way they dismissed Crystal Palace was impressive. It's a number of wins in a row now for them, and they were always the bookies' favourites even before this weekend's games. They were, I think, leading the betting, and that makes sense just because of the way they've done it in past two out of the last three seasons. And Solskjaer, to be fair, was very pointed. I think it's probably in terms of managing expectations. But before the game, I asked him about the change in mentality from being the pursuer to now actually leading the race. And he was very much making the point that United are still the hunters rather than the hunted. And I mean, listen, that's a classic managerial tactic, isn't it? I think Klopp probably did the same a couple of times when Liverpool were in the hunt, and he wanted to just make sure that there wasn't any kind of case of getting too excited. But yeah, I think United have to see this as an opportunity, because the points total just won't be as high as it has been, in the last three seasons. So, why not go for it this season? Admittedly, as Adam says, I think there needs to be a big performance from United in a really big game. So that one at the Etihad is sort of looking the likeliest. You wonder if they need to go there and win that game. They've done it before. They've done it under Solskjaer twice. So it wouldn't, it's not impossible. So, but yeah, I think they have to consider themselves the title contenders.
There are certain ex-pros and pundits who are still quite cynical when they talk about Paul Pogba, with me saying, oh, well, he's upped his form at the moment with the possibility of a move, and the club are going to have, actually, they do have a decision to make this summer.
Yeah, huge decision. It was something I wrote about in November, I think it was, just the fact that it didn't look like he was going to sign a new contract. Those talks had been parked, and United therefore had, could sell him in January. It was always, very unlikely that was going to happen. But, next summer was going to be the big one, this one that we're coming up to, in a few months now. What do they do? Because if they keep him, they'll end up losing him on a free, you'd think. Can they sell him and get enough money? Are the clubs out there that are willing to pay that kind of transfer fee, then also give him the wage that he would obviously demand? So it's going to be an interesting one for United, what they do. Ideally, I think they'd like to, if he is intent on leaving, as his agent has expressed, then they would like to sell him for some significant amount of money and reinvest that in another player that would clearly want to be at the club. I'm a massive fan of Jack Grealish. James Maddison, I thought, they've looked at him previously, and I was really impressed with the way he spoke after the game for Leicester the other day. So you've got options there, but they clearly need to get money in for him before, I think, a swap deal, which is what a lot of the European clubs will try and do. Does that appeal for United? Will they be getting a player in the door that is really what they want? I think Solskjaer's shown that actually he's quite happy to make the point that he only wants players in that he really does want. Although I suppose we've still got a question mark over Donny van de Beek at the moment. Hopefully, I mean, maybe he's the replacement already, in the building, although he is a different type of player to Paul Pogba. So yeah, but it's a very live issue, and I wonder, I'm probably more, enjoying. I mean, I've been scathing of Paul Pogba at various times. Last season when he was, recovering from injury, with basketball sessions in Miami, I was rolling my eyes, and the rooftops in Dubai didn't really seem to correlate with a player that was busting a gut to get back into a team that was failing and needed his inspiration. But I wonder if the prospect of United winning a title or going for a title race, at least, has invigorated him. As we saw the World Cup with France, when there's a clear objective on the horizon, he can, produce some really good performances. And I wonder if that's sort of at play here, rather than a sort of more obvious attempt to just raise his transfer value and make sure that he gets a good club. I'm sort of more leaning on the, maybe it's a naive of me to think that way, but that's the way I'm leaning at the moment.
Right. Adam went through a whole variety of facial expressions during that answer, so I can't work out what you agreed with Adam and what you didn't agree with.
That's just Adam.
I agreed with the bit in Dubai and Miami. I think with Pogba, I mean, people are talking about him over the last few weeks as though he's gone out and won a load of games for Manchester United. He's had two or three good performances, and I'm wary of coming across a bit sort of Roy Keane here, but he was good against Aston Villa. He scored a deflected winner against Burnley. He worked hard yesterday.
I know it was deflected, but it was a good volley.
It was a good volley, but it wouldn't have gone in if it wasn't deflected. I think he's been good, but he's not gone out and won a load of games for Manchester United and defined the season for them. I thought he was good yesterday. He had the chance to define the game. He wasn't able to do it. It was a good save. I still think he had a really damaging impact on the team in terms of that European campaign, with the agent's comments coming out before the Leipzig game. I don't think that's something that should be forgotten very quickly. I think it's up to him, isn't it? You know, we know the talent he's got. I think one of the interesting things is if you lose Paul Pogba, how do you replace him? Because he's almost he doesn't have a position. So, you know, you lose Pogba, you don't think, oh, we need to get a holding midfielder, or we need to get an attacking midfielder, we need to get a winger. He sort of does a bit of everything and master of none at the moment. You know, for a world-class central midfielder, actually to still not be trusted to play at Anfield as part of a three-man central midfield, I thought was quite interesting yesterday, that, you know, United couldn't afford to risk going with one holding midfielder and playing Pogba and Fernandes. So he's still having to play out on the wide, quite an unnatural position for him. I thought he did well in that position, but I don't think United are going to be losing something hugely defining to them. But then there's always this contradiction that if he really buckles down, he could be the difference for them. And that's what makes it so hard to work out where that whole journey with United and Pogba, it's always what it could be rather than any evidence of what we've seen it is.
And for that very reason, at a club like Manchester United, who have given this a fair amount of time now, and we factor in his comments, those of his agent, we should say, which shows a clear direction of travel from their point of view. The view of me as an outsider is that he can have a contribution this season, do well. It doesn't appear that he'll gain any sort of consistency on the long term. If he wants to leave and will bring in good money and there will be decent offers for him, just get this over with, part amicably, and then we know there's admiration for the likes of Grealish and Maddison. Look to the next opportunity and somebody that can take United back to the level that they want to be on a consistent basis. I don't think it's one that looks from the outside to be going on for much longer, even if he does do well towards the end of the season.
I do think as well there's a sense that United have a lot of players in that team at the moment who all want to do the killer thing when they get the ball, whether that's the killer pass straight away or get a shot off straight away. I think Pogba's another of those players. And you watch them yesterday, and they're all very impatient to play that one ball over the top or get that one shot away. You see that with Fernandes, often with Martial, with Rashford, with Greenwood. I don't think it would harm them to have a couple more players in the team who actually are just confident dictating play, keeping the ball, slowing it down at times, rather than always having to go very, very quick on that counter-attack. So I don't think it would be as bad for United as maybe it appears at the moment that it would be to lose Pogba.
Speaking of Paul Pogba's agent, in the column, David, there's a story about one of his other clients and that Chelsea are keen to usurp everybody else and sign Erling Haaland.
Yeah, this is a story brought to us by Simon Johnson, our colleague on The Athletic, who reports on Chelsea, has some great contacts in and around the club. And he says that Chelsea are going to make a really big push to sign Haaland in the summer of 2021, which is a year before his release clause comes into effect. And the view from some at Chelsea clearly is that many clubs will be waiting for that release clause and Chelsea might be able to nip in. We've seen how much they've spent over the last year following their transfer ban. We've seen how decisively they've moved to secure some of the best talents in European football. In theory, not so much in practice recently, but they'll hope that changes. And Haaland could well be the next one on that list. Now, they will need a striker because Olivier Giroud's contract is scheduled to expire. Tammy Abraham is yet to renew a contract that expires in 2023. Timo Werner, they will of course hope comes good, but he probably isn't that sort of hold up central man. He may be seen as playing off of somebody like Haaland, according to Simon's report. There are, however, complicating factors here. even this summer, those other clubs are not stupid. If Chelsea are in, there will be other clubs in. The likes of Manchester City have been linked with him, Manchester United, but having already missed out on him once, and Laurie may tell us more, I don't see that being a realistic one second time round. Real Madrid is said to be his preference. If they can afford it, then that will be a really interesting one to watch, because they, and this brings me on to my next point about Raiola, tend to pay higher agents' fees. And Mino Raiola has shown throughout his career, unashamedly, that he operates on the basis of, in part, who will pay the biggest or the required agents' commissions. Dortmund seemingly did that to get Haaland. Will Chelsea be willing to go down that road? Abramovich, Marina Granovskaya, especially when they had a bad experience with Raiola when they tried to bring Romelu Lukaku back. I think it was in 2017-18 when he joined Manchester United. He's no longer with Mino Raiola, to my understanding, but that was a bruising experience with him. And there'll be other factors at play as well. The boy's preference, not least. But what we're reporting is that Chelsea are going to make a concerted effort to sign him next summer.
If Chelsea got the funds then, do you think, David, after sort of the spending so heavily in this summer?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, we know Roman Abramovich has the funds and shown plenty of willing to spend it over the last year to sort of propel Chelsea back to where he wants them to be. It's clearly going to take time. Financial fair play rules have been relaxed somewhat, but you can't just turn a blind eye to that. It would be breaking their transfer record if they were to do it this coming summer and not wait for the clause, a record that has been set by Kai Havertz. But Chelsea will also be looking to get players out. They failed to do as much as they wanted to through the exit door last summer. They will try again this January as we record this. Danny Drinkwater has been announced on loan to a Turkish club for the rest of the season. Little incremental deals like that, which relieve space on their wage bill for the time being and then try to move them on permanently in the summer. If they can't move them on permanently in January, the likes of Marcos Alonso, for example, maybe Fikayo Tomori, who sounds like he's going to AC Milan on loan with a 30 million option to buy. So there is space to maneuver there before you think about Abramovich and the opportunity again to get a generational talent like Erling Haaland. I suppose, without knowing Chelsea's finances inside out, that they can finance it. And if they don't, somebody else will.
Well, that's the thing. Obviously, United, as we've written before, Solskjaer certainly would like to get Haaland to Manchester United. I can see Chappers furrowing his brow as I sort of suggest.
Do you know
that?
What I was furrowing my brow at? I was thinking, my God, what kind of deal was Danny Drinkwater on that if he's been moved out, that frees up the funds to bring in Erling Haaland? I was thinking, good grief.
Quite a good contract, right, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Anyhow, go on.
I mean, Solskjaer's obviously tried to get Haaland. I mean, he even tried to get Haaland to Manchester United when he was Mould manager and recommended them. And I think that, you know, perhaps the scouting reports weren't as glowing as he reflected on. And then Mino Raiola got involved and, you know, he went to Red Bull Salzburg and you know, therefore and on to Borussia Dortmund afterwards. And you know, that, I think that still bruises Manchester United, the way that that deal to Borussia Dortmund happened and, you know, who's ultimately responsible, where was the fault. You'd think that with Solskjaer at the club, that would be an appealing thing for a player that he's worked with previously, that obviously the Norwegian look as well. I think there is a good relationship still there. You know, it's not like Solskjaer's fallen out with them over that, but clearly the Raiola factor is a big one. And does that play into what happens with Pogba? You know, it's going to be an interesting thing. I mean, that's, you know, the release clause for Erling Haaland at Borussia Dortmund, that's what United basically said no to, and that's what, this is the kind of situation they perhaps, you know, predicted. And, you know, do Dortmund have the full wherewithal to reject any advances this summer, you know, albeit they don't have to, there's no clause that makes them have to sell him, but could they actually say no to something when they know they are going to lose him for a set fee the summer afterwards? Am I right in saying, I don't know, Adam, if you probably know more about this than me, but Mino Raiola and Real Madrid, haven't they not dealt with him too much in the past few years over Florentino Perez's understanding of it?
Yeah, I mean, as far I was told a few months ago now that Real Madrid have been very, very reluctant to do deals with Mino Raiola. I can't remember a prominent one that they have done with him, but it seemed like it was a decision that they've taken to basically say, we're Real Madrid and, you know, we're not going to be necessarily treated it in this way, in the way that maybe Manchester United have been over the last few years when they had a series of Raiola players. I think Madrid's priority would probably be to try and get Mbappe if they can, but obviously that's very difficult. And just those two big Spanish clubs at the moment just aren't in a position, I don't think, to financially compete with Manchester United, Chelsea, Manchester City this summer. I mean, you speak to clubs, major clubs around Europe at the moment, there is not this sense of we're going to blitz the market this summer. I think that was maybe the hope last August, September, that, you know, a year into the pandemic, maybe things will be a bit easier. I don't think this summer will be, you know, a return to 2019 levels of spending. I think it will phase its way forward. And I think what you'll probably see is those big players at PSG probably realizing we're going to have to sign a new contract here and stay here. And it may even be that, you know, Dortmund, you know, it comes down to, I suppose, who enters the bidding for him this time around. But we saw with Dortmund last summer with Sancho that you know, they are not a club who go easily, who see Manchester United or Chelsea coming along and say, here you go. You know, they make it difficult. They squeeze every last penny out of it. They take you on a bit of a ride as well from a public relations point of view. They talk about it a lot. So it's a big decision for United in terms of if they want to go into that race again and go through that process again. Because if they lose out again and waste a lot of time in doing so and miss out on other targets, it becomes, you know, really complicated for Ed Woodward.
That's an especially good point on Dortmund when you consider the Jadon Sancho situation, because he is expected to leave this summer. And though the figure may be lower than it might have been last summer, it may generate the sort of money that negates the need to do business for Haaland at all before his release clause. And that would be the sort of, I mean, we don't know what role Raiola would play in that, but that would be akin to the sort of way Dortmund tend to act. I'm just really intrigued when you said the potential options, Manchester City. I think that's absolutely fascinating to see what they do with the striker situation without taking this off down another tangent. Sergio Aguero has not been invited for contract talks over a new deal. Suggestions that if he is, it will be a pay reduction. There's been all the talk about Lionel Messi. Mbappe, I don't think, for Manchester City, despite being linked. Haaland, I imagine there's some credible interest there, especially with his father's background and his quality, etc.
There's been difficulties in the past, hasn't there, with Raiola and Pep over Zlatan Ibrahimovic. And also, I think Pep accused Raiola of offering Paul Pogba to Manchester City while he was a Manchester United player on the eve of a derby. Again, football works really strangely, and we've seen so many times over the years where people appear to not be on speaking terms and then do multi-million pound deals together. So I don't think it's impossible. And Manchester City are crying out for a top level striker, but that is something which would have to, the dynamics of that relationship would have to change, because I don't think Pep, having gone through Zlatan at Barca and Raiola at Barca, I don't know if he's got the patience for 3 or 4 years of that relationship.
Okay, Adam, thank you. That piece is on The Athletic, which you can read now. Laurie and David, thank you as well. You can read the articles we discussed on today's podcast in full on The Athletic. Subscribe now for just £3.99 a month. It means you get all the great analysis and the in-depth features from the very best football writers around. Plus, you get ad-free versions of all of our podcasts. So to do that, theathletic.com/Ornstein and Chapman. And I'm back on this podcast feed on Thursday alongside Matt Slater for our new podcast, The Business of Sport.
The Athletic.